I just want to comment the last remark that if you ask questions, you're not going to find out the balance of the information. Baruch Hashem, this is a particular subject in which we will all find out the answers eventually. So if you don't get it in the class, we will find out one way or the other, hopefully in a good way. But this is our last shiur for this particular subject. Again, if I had to tell you what is the most important fundamental takeaway, let me just reiterate again, is that there's a fundamental disagreement. What is the role of Mashiach? What is the Messianic era? According to the Rambam, the ultimate reward that God gives us is Olam Haba. That is the ultimate. And Mashiach is simply an experience in this world to enable us to do the mitzvot and have a Beit HaMikdash and thereby earn more Olam Haba. Meaning to say, according to the Rambam, Mashiach is not an end. Mashiach is a means, kedei shenizkeh li'olam haba, and even techiyat ha-meitim is not an end. It simply is a way to fold in the earlier generations so they too can partake of the opportunities of Yemot HaMashiach to be able to serve Hashem in a more intense way. So according to the Rambam, I wouldn't say Mashiach is unimportant. Obviously, it's an ikir emunah, but Mashiach is not the end point of things. People will die after Mashiach comes, and people will die after Techiyas HaMeisim. The people who will be revived are going to die too. Meaning the only thing that is eternal, according to the Rambam, is the Olam HaNeshamot, and which exists even now. When people die, they go to Olam Haba. Now, that is the Rambam's limited view of Yemot HaMashiach as the Emtsa'i to give us more Zechuyot to go to Olam Haba. By contrast, the view of Ramban and the Mekubalim is that Mashiach is the ultimate purpose of creation to bring God and godliness into this physical world, in the language that Chabad quotes a lot from the Tanya, although it's really from a Medrash, that Hashem's greatest desire is to have a dira b'tachtonim, a dwelling place in this lower world. And Olam Haba, according to Ramban, lehepach, that's the way station. That's where we're kind of parked. The people who die are parked until such time as there is the resurrection of the dead in the Messianic era. At some point, it won't necessarily be at the beginning, and that will be Nitzchi. According to Ramban, the ultimate Olam Haba, in fact, the Ramban, in terms of terminology, even in terms of vocabulary, Olam Haba does not refer to the world of the soul. That is called Gan Eden. Olam Haba means the coming world of Techiyat HaMeitim that will happen after Yemot HaMashiach. Now, I have to say that in spite of the Rambam's huge authority, the standard understanding that is typically conveyed of Yemot HaMashiach and Techiyat HaMeitim actually follows the Ramban and the Kabbalists. In fact, it's been well said that mainstream Judaism is largely Kabbalistic, whether you like that or not. The truth of the matter is the rationalistic traditions of the Rambam have largely not been the mainstream of religious Judaism, and people are debating, you know, should that be changed, should we go back to Rambam, etc. I will leave that maybe for another time, or another person who wants to walk into that controversy. That's a very, very major controversy. But it's very, very fascinating how much Kabbalah has influenced the direction of regular Judaism. You know, even people who never learned Kabbalah are not Kabbalists, are not mystics in any way. The general practices and the general philosophies of Judaism, as articulated today within the much of the Torah observant world, are largely Kabbalistic ideas, and the Rambam would not necessarily agree with them. So that's kind of the major point. The role of Mashiach and Techiyat HaMeitim is a major, major focus in terms of what is the end point and what is the end goal. The other thing I just wanted to mention, someone had talked to me right before the class, is that the Rambam talked about the fact that Mashiach is not going to be deciding yichus questions. Who is a Jew? Who is a mamzer? Who is a kohen? Basically, the Mashiach is going to basically say, whoever is in, whoever is out, he is not going to be making decisions that people who are excluded will be included, or people who are included will be excluded. Mashiach does not get involved in Yichud. So apparently, some matters are so controversial that even Mashiach doesn't want to touch them. And this Yichud thing is one of them. Now, in truth, I do have a problem with this that I don't fully understand. I do understand it in one sense. I do understand the idea that if somebody is accepted as a Jew, Mashiach is not going to come and be merachid. Let the person be accepted. Let him in. He's already in. It's not Mashiach's job to discredit. What bothers me a little bit more, though, is, but why can't it work the other way? If somebody, let's say, was excluded, why can't Mashiach come and bring him back in if he deserves to be brought back in? L'chaira, there's a certain injustice there that if somebody is actually a Jew or a Kohen, they should be excluded. So why there's a total hands-off policy, I don't fully understand. But it's interesting that somebody brought to my attention, I actually did not see this story, that the Rabbanut is now using a DNA to determine, to try to determine Jewish status. I guess before Mashiach comes, since Mashiach is not going to get involved, we got to kind of do it now. And there's a whole interesting issue generally about whether halacha accepts DNA, because you know it's not the typical two atom, so to speak. On the other hand, scientifically, DNA has a very, very high level. DNA testing has a very, very high level of probability and the like. And this comes up in a number of contexts. Typically, DNA has not been used to establish Jewish status, but it is often used in aguna cases. If you have victims of calamities like the World Trade Center or whatever it would be, and sometimes there's nothing, you can't recognize the facial features of the body, right? So there are different things you can do. There's fingerprints, there's dental records, but sometimes all you can get is a DNA sample. And the question is, can DNA establish halachic identity to allow an aguna to remarry? So again, as you would guess, it is a big machlokas poskim, many poskim, and this was the position of the OU in the aftermath of the World Trade Center, relying on Rav Belsky, Rav Herschel Schechter, and other poskim in America, and Rav Zalman Chemia Goldberg here, very, 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 very chashuva posek, and actually Rav Asher Weiss as well, that DNA is as good or better than halachic testimony. And as a result, an aguna could marry based on DNA. On the other hand, Rav Al Yashiv, Zichrono Livracha, did not consider DNA to be sufficiently reliable, simply because he said there was sometimes tampering or mistakes on the part of the technicians, which actually is true. There's a surprising percentage of mistakes that are made in the on the technical side of it, and as a result, he paskin DNA cannot matter in aguna. But this has an interesting leniency, and that is, the halacha is the following. Let's say a married woman has an affair. Now, the child that is born from such an affair would be a mamzer. However, halacha has a tremendous, amazing loophole, and that is, even if we know the woman has had an affair, if she's still living with her husband, halacha assumes that any child she has is from her husband, as long as she's living with her husband. And this is true even if the child looks like the other person. So what? Now, the question becomes, what if DNA testing demonstrates it's not from the husband? Could that make the child a mamzer? So interestingly enough, Rav Al Yashiv, who was so strict not to allow DNA to matir and aguna, by that very same logic, he said, DNA cannot make a child a mamzer, right? So it works in different ways. Sometimes a certain position can be lenient, and sometimes it can be strict, based on the same consideration. The Rabbanut, obviously, is following the similar mahalach to Rav Schechter, Rav Zalman, Nathaniel Goldberg, which allows DNA to establish identity. And in truth, this actually goes back to a psak much, much earlier, which did not involve DNA, it involved blood testing, but it's the same type of principle. going back to Rav Herzog. Rav Herzog was the first chief rabbi of the Medina. Rav Kook was prior to the Medina. And Rav Herzog ruled all the way back in the early 1950s that blood tests and the like, which have scientific validity, are just as good as edutz, and they can be relied upon. So essentially, the Rabbanut's Mahalech is really following, is building on the validation of scientific evidence that Rav Herzog paskened all the way back in the 1950s. So that's just a little bit of a digression regarding DNA and yichus. And as I say, these matters have to be resolved now. One other little point about this, because it's a bit of a digression, and that is, you know, people talk about the Cohen gene. And it's very, very important to understand that the Cohen gene can under no circumstances establish that somebody is a Kohen, because although it is a male-based gene, kahuna can be forfeited by virtue of the mother. For example, very simple example, if a Kohen marries a divorced woman, the child is a chalal, which means he's not a mamzer, but he is no longer a Kohen, even though he has a direct male line from Aaron HaKohen. Or, to take an even more extreme case, if a Kohen marries a Goy, not a Gioris, a Goy, the child is a Goy, even though he is a direct male descendant of Aaron. So at most, the absence of the Kohen gene might prove that he's not a Kohen. But the presence of the Kohen gene cannot prove that he is a Kohen. Many of you might remember William Cohen. I think he died recently. I don't remember. He was the Secretary of Defense under Jimmy Carter. And William Cohen is a guy, or was a guy. His mother was not Jewish, even though his father may have been a Cohen. I don't even know if that was true, and the like. So obviously, the fact that your name is Cohen means nothing at all, besides the fact that in Ellis Island, they often gave people those names. But even if someone is really a Kohen marries a Goy, the kid is a Goy, not a Kohen, right? So obviously the Kohen gene is a false positive, even though it might be a true negative, meaning a false positive means that the presence of it cannot prove anything. The absence of it might prove you're not a Kohen if you accept it. According to Rebbe Yashiv, I would assume that the gene, you know, means nothing one way or the other because he disregards the scientific evidence. Okay, so that's a little bit of a digression. Now, let me go back to the last point that I made last week, and that is the two conspicuous omissions in the Rambam's discussion of Mashiach. One is he omits any mention of Mashiach ben Yosef, and the second is he omits any mention of the significance of the year 6000. Right, the Rambam simply mentions neither of those two points. And last week we did talk about Mashiach ben Yosef a little bit. Again, let me remind you of the idea that the Gemara in Sukkah does tell us that there will be a Mashiach ben Yosef who will be killed in the wars of Gog and Magog before the coming of the Mashiach. And there will be a eulogy and a hesped for Mashiach ben Yosef. But then we have the writings of the Vilna Gaon that says that it doesn't have to be that way. That is one type of scenario. But through Zechuyot, Mitzvot, and Masim Tovim, and Torah, it is shayach that Mashiach ben Yosef may turn into a movement rather than a person. And the movement would be the physical building up of Eretz Yisrael and the return of the Jews to the homeland. This was the Vilna Gaon's thesis. As reported by his Talmud, Rav Hillel of Shklov, in the Sefer Kol HaTor, in which the physical Binyan Ha'aretz is an indispensable prerequisite to the coming of Mashiach ben David. So instead of saying, we will come back to the land when Mashiach comes, the Vilna Gaon writes, it's exactly the opposite. We must come to the land, and that will bring the Mashiach, that will bring the Geula. So the Vilna Gaon was a proto-Zionist, a pre-Zionist Zionist, and there is no question that although he did not go as far as Rav Kook, who saw even secular, non-religious or anti-religious Zionism as a spiritual endeavor to bring God's people home. Rav Kook kind of spiritualized even secular Zionism. One cannot say that the Vilna Gaon did that, but there is no question that books like the Kol HaTor had a tremendous hashpa'ah in Lithuania. They were part of the thinking of the Netziv, they were part of the thinking of Rav Kook, and this had a very, very great influence. And remember, the Vilna Gaon in Lithuania was, you know, the greatest, most authoritative figure of all the Gedolei Yisrael, and his teachings would have a tremendous, tremendous impact. And there is no question that the Vilna Gaon did inspire not only his Talmidim, but many of the Rabbanim who joined to the Mizrahi, you know, the religious Zionists in the early years, whether it was Rav Reines and the like, Rav Shmuel Molivar, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, all of them were very much influenced by this type of writing to eventually see even Zionism as kind of Mashiach ben Yosef. In fact, people even said about Herzl that Herzl was, maybe with some hyperbole, Herzl was kind of a fulfillment of Mashiach ben Yosef in one way. Again, I am not saying at all that Vilna Gaon would have agreed with that. I'm not saying that at all, but it's kind of based on this idea. And the one thing the Vilna Gaon does establish is that Eretz Yisrael is not only about the yeshivos and the kollelim. It is about cultivating fields and building factories and building homes and building an infrastructure of the land, because that is what Yosef did in Mitzrayim. Yosef created the infrastructure, the economic structure that allowed the Jewish people to come to Goshen, and therefore that is the role of Mashiach ben Yosef. Now let me just mention one thing, that there is another role that Mashiach ben Yosef has that's actually very relevant to this week's Parsha Zohar, and that is, there's a fascinating Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra that says, Ein Zaro Shel Esav Nofel Ela Biyad Zaro Shel Rachel. The descendants of Esav, which includes Amalek, can only be defeated by the children of Rachel and not by the children of Leah. And we see this historically. The first war against Amalek, Amalek was the first nation that attacked us when we left Mitzrayim, the very first nation. Remember when the Jewish people left Mitzrayim? So the Medrash describes them as a boiling bath. Every nation was afraid to even touch them because these were a people who broke Mitzrayim. They left with plagues and Kriyas Yamsuf. And every nation, no one dared attack the Jewish people. But Amalek, without provocation and with no reason, jumped into this cauldron, jumped into this boiling bath. And what happened? They got burnt, to be sure. But they cooled it off for the next guy. Right? So that's Amalek. Now, who was the general that was put in charge of the war against Amalek? Hoshea, who later became Yehoshua, Hoshea ben Nun, from the tribe of Ephraim, who is Yosef's son, who is Rachel's son. Amalek has to be defeated by the children of Rachel and not Leah. I'll explain why in a moment, but I want to show you the pattern. The next commandment to eradicate Amalek was given to Shaul HaMelech, who is from the tribe of Binyamin. And in fact, many Mefarshim say that is the whole reason for Shaul's malchus. The whole malchus of Shaul is a problem, really. Yaakov Avinu said in his bracha to Yehuda, Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda. The scepter of malchus, the scepter of authority, has to belong to Yehuda, David HaMelech. So why is there this malchus Binyamin? Why is the first melech of the Jews Shaul HaMelech? What is the purpose of malchus Shaul? And one of the answers that's given is that Malchus Beis David cannot come until Amalek is eradicated, and that can only be done by a child of Rachel, which means Shaul didn't complete his mission. He spared Agag, but his function, in other words, Shaul vis-a-vis David, is an exact parallel to Mashiach ben Yosef. Now, why is it sometimes Yosef, sometimes Binyamin? That's a good question. But you see, the relationship of Shaul to David is Mashiach ben Yosef to Mashiach ben David. And that is, Shaul's job was to destroy Amalek. In the story of Purim, Mordechai and Esther are the descendants of Shaul, and they engineer the downfall of Haman, who was the descendant of Agag, the king of Amalek, that Shaul failed to kill. Now, it's true that Shmuel killed Agag, but as Chazal tell us, in the small amount of time between Shmuel letting Agag go and Shaul letting Agag go and Shmuel killing Agag, Agag impregnated somebody, and that became the ancestor of Haman, right? So we see that the role of Mashiach ben Yosef, we don't know exactly how, is to destroy the Amalek of the world, to pave the way for Mashiach ben David, based on the teaching that Amalek and Esav can only be defeated by the children of Rachel and not the children of Leah. Now, why is that so? Why is it so that it is only Rachel's children that can vanquish Amalek and it is not Leah's children? So there are different reasons that are given, but one reason is that Amalek represents the epitome of sinat chinam, of hatred. Amalek really is related to us in some ways, right? Amalek is Esav's grandson. Esav had a son, Eliphaz. Eliphaz had a son from his Pelegesh, his concubine Timnah, and that son is Amalek. Amalek has violent, irrational hatred. All of the children of Leah that sold Yosef were guilty of that same defect of character. Therefore, they cannot fight Amalek, because they have that Amalek within them. It is only the children of Rachel. Yosef was the victim, and Binyamin did not participate. And Rachel herself exemplified selfless love in giving her sister the secret identifying signs that would enable her sister to be with Yaakov their wedding night without her being humiliated. She's helping her sister cheat her. What type of obligation do you have to help somebody deprive you of what is rightfully yours? And yet, this was the level of the love that Rachel had. So because of Rachel and because of Yosef and Binyamin, who were not tainted with sinat chinam and lehepech, there was love, they were able to vanquish the evil of Amalek. So consequently, in one way or the other, and we can't really know exactly what form this is going to take, the role of Mashiach ben Yosef, Mizera Rachel, is Lahachris Zaro Shel Amalek, and thereby pave the way. So the Gra views Mashiach ben Yosef as settling Eretz Yisrael. Others view it as destroying the powers of Amalek. Let me mention another point about this, and that is, the Pasuk says, which is also a remez to Mashiach ben Yosef, the Pasuk says in Amos, Hine yamim boim noam Hashem, behold, days are coming, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'nigash choresh Bekotzer, that the plower, the one who's plowing, will encounter the harvester. By that it means that the productivity of the land will be so great that people will still be harvesting when it's time to plow for the new year, meaning the harvest is going to last all the way to Cheshvan, right? The grain will be so much, they'll still be harvesting grain when they got a plow for the new planting season. It's a beautiful pasuk. It's promising productivity, prosperity. But the Medrash has an intriguing comment The Medrash says, the Choresh, the plower, is Yosef. I'm sorry, the other way. The Choresh is Yehuda, and the harvester is Yosef. V'nigash Choresh b'kotzer is the eventual joinder of Yosef and Yehuda, as it says, V'yigash Elav Yehuda, when Yehuda goes to Yosef to beg for Binyamin. And this is also a remez that Yosef, Mashiach ben Yosef, will be nitchaber with the descendant of David, Mashiach ben Yehuda, which is Mashiach ben David. Now the question becomes, why would Yosef be called the harvester and David called the plower, or Yehuda, not David, Yehuda called the plower? So the Avnei Nezer, the Sacher Chevre Rebbe, says the following, that Yosef and Yehuda deal with two different models of leadership. Yosef is subjected to great temptation in Potiphar's house. The mistress of the house tempts him day after day after day, shichva imi, lie with me. She begs, she cajoles, and Yosef is so strong, and Yosef is so righteous, that Yosef represents the person who simply says no to the Yetzer Hara. And that's why he's called a harvester. Because what is the halachic definition of harvesting on Shabbat? Oker davar migidulo. You sever something from the ground. The ground is a remez to my earthiness, my Yetzer Hara, my taivas. Yosef just separates himself from the earthy and the physical and the material. Yosef represents the leader who is so strong and so perfect that Yosef totally rejects any ra. By contrast, when Yehuda is subjected to a temptation by what he thinks is a prostitute, it happens to be his daughter-in-law, but he doesn't know that, Tamar, Yehuda is nichshel. So Yehuda represents, now this is again a controversial thought, and how it actually plays out is difficult. But the concept is this. That's called choresh. What is choresh? Unlike kotzer, where the plant is separated from the ground, choresh takes the dirt and softens it, refines it, makes it receptive to Kedusha. So the Sfas Emes writes, the difference between the leadership of Yosef and the leadership of Yehuda is, the leadership of Yosef is the person who does not succumb to evil or mistake. The leadership of Yehuda is the person who fails, but shows us how to come back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu with tshuva. And the reason why the ultimate leader of Am Yisrael comes from Yehuda, and of course David and Bathsheba is a similar thing. David and Bathsheba plays out the same idea of being nichshal b'aveira, whatever the aveira was, and doing tshuva. If a melech is supposed to be a role model, sometimes the role model is not the person who is so perfect that they never fail. Because that's not a role model for us. We fail all the time. The role model for us is the person that can show us that even when we have Yerida, we can come back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Yosef is called the Kotzer. He separates himself from the Artziyot, from the Chumriyot, from the Gashmiyot. Yehuda, out of that very Gashmiyot, Chumriyot, creates a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, again, you know, I remember a comment of Rav Putner many years ago when Art Scroll and other publishers were putting out biographies of great Gedolim. So Rav Putner didn't like some of those biographies because they portrayed portraits of superhuman beings who never made any mistakes at all. So when this Gadol was 4 years old, he made his first Siyam HaShas. and by the fifth birthday was Yerushalmi, and by Bar Mitzvah, all of the Kitzvei Arizal, knowing Dalet Chelkei Shulchan Aruch by heart. So you read those things, and you know, they're entertaining, and you know, amazing, and you have Kavod HaTorah. But the question becomes, what does that mean for me and for my children? We're not going to do that. We're not going to be that. It's not possible for us. But Rav Fugger pointed out, and he knew, of course, he knew. He himself was a Gadol, and he knew many of the Gadolim from the prior generation. That Gadolim were not always born Gadolim. Gadolim had struggles. Gadolim had yeridas. We know the Chafetz Chaim, when he was 85 and older, trained himself to fall asleep if he spoke Lashon Hara. And in truth, when you're 85, that's not so hard to fall asleep. It's not so hard. Even at 60, it's not so hard already. But the thing is, what was the Chafetz Chaim like when he was 15? Did he have to struggle with this? Did he ever make mistakes in this area? Now, granted, Rav Huttner says there are issues of Lashon Hara. Are you allowed to talk about it? Okay, that's a difficult thing. But Rav Huttner made the point that often we can learn much more from the struggles of a great person than from their successes. If all we have is a record of unbroken successes, that really is not a manual for me. I need to know what happens when things go wrong. What happens when I make mistakes? What happens when I'm nichshal? How do I come back to Hashem? How do I grow from my mistakes? Right? And Mimela, the Sfas Emes, says that that is why, ultimately, Malchus comes from Shevet Yehuda rather than from Yosef. Yosef is the perfect person who never sins. Yehuda is the person who teaches us how to come back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even with our failures. Now again, to apply this practically is very, very difficult because in Lemaisa, certainly in the Israeli political system, including religious parties, we have numerous examples of people who have failed in many, many ways, and then they want to come back for our votes, and the question is, should they get our vote? You know, so they might quote the Sfas Emes and say, yeah, I got to vote for me. I'm showing you the way to come back after failure. You know, okay, that's hard to gauge. You know, but it's hard for us to gauge the sincerity and depth of a person's real tshuva when they're looking for political office and the like. But it's a fascinating idea that the ultimate malchus comes from situations where there are pegamim, where there are defects, where there are averos, where there's michshel, because we have to learn, as the Pasuk says in Mishlei, Sheva yipal tzaddik v'kam, the tzaddik falls seven times but gets up again. That nefila doesn't just mean external obstacle, but even when the tzaddik commits an avera, and it might happen, he knows to get up, he knows how to get up. He doesn't allow himself to be crushed or despondent. And that's the great mitzvah, that's the idea of the transition from the mode of perfection of Mashiach ben Yosef to the notion of a flaw in Mashiach ben David. And of course we know that the greatness of David, of both Yehuda and his descendant, David HaMelech, is they did fail, but they took responsibility. You know, the Sefer HaYikarim, Rav Yosef Albo, raises the question, Shaul HaMelech is given one strike and he's out. He fails to kill Amalek, that's it. No second chances. And David HaMelech has a chait with Bathsheba, and although he suffers tremendously, he loses a child, and Avshalom almost kills him, and of course he loses Avshalom also. But the one thing that doesn't happen is, he doesn't lose his malchus. Why is Hashem so much more forgiving of David than he is forgiving of Shaul? This is Rav Yosef Albo's kasha. And Rav Yosef Albo answers, the difference is not in the sin. The difference is in the response. When Shmuel confronts Shaul and says, why did you not listen to the commandment of Hashem? What Shaul does is, Shaul, number one, first he denies it, I did everything. And then when he can't deny it anymore, because Shmuel says, I hear the sheep, etc., he blames other people. He basically says, I was afraid of the people, they made me do it. When David is with Bathsheba, now the funny thing is, David had all sorts of excuses. David had excuses. Number one, Chazal tell us, Bathsheba had a get, because when soldiers went off to war, they would divorce their wives, so there shouldn't be a missing in action aguna. And Uriah Hachiti disobeyed an order of David, so David had the right to kill him and send him to the front. So David had all sorts of excuses. And yet, when Nathan HaNavi, Shmuel is not alive anymore, when Nathan HaNavi comes to David and gives him the parable of a rich man and a poor man, and the poor and the rich man had many, many sheep, took the one sheep of the poor man and shechted it. What should happen to such a person? And David HaMelech says, such a wretched person deserves to die. And Nathan HaNavi said to David, you are that person. And David had excuses. And David said, Chatasi Lashem, I have sinned. Rav Yosef Albo says, that is the key here. Hashem understands that even the greatest tzaddik can make a mistake. And that does not disqualify you from leadership. But what is necessary is you take achrayas, you take responsibility. And that was the greatness of David HaMelech. And of course, that was the trait that he learned from his ancestor Yehuda. When Tamar, that Yehuda thinks committed adultery because she was pledged to his son, she's about to be burnt at the stake, and she does not want to reveal Yehuda's identity because, as Chazal say, it is better to be thrown into a fiery furnace without embarrassing somebody publicly. But she simply says, the man that gave me this money belt and staff, he was the man that I was with. And the only person in the world who knew who that belonged to was Yehuda himself. Nobody else knew. Yehuda could have kept quiet. But he stepped forward and he said, Sadka mimeni, she is more righteous than I. Moda al ha'emes. And David HaMelech was Moda al ha'emes. And that is the quality of the Messianic Redeemer, to be Moda al ha'emes. Okay, so this is another reflection on the difference between Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Now, let me speak a little bit about the second omission in the Rambam. So the first omission is the Rambam omits the discussion of Mashiach ben Yosef. The second omission of the Rambam is that the Rambam omits any significance to the year 6,000. He simply does not mention any type of calculation in that direction. And all of us know that in many, many sources, 6,000 is considered to be the outer limit by which Mashiach must come, based on the idea that the world was created in 6 days, and each day of creation corresponds to a millennium of 1,000 years, and therefore, by the year 6,000, we have completed 6 days, and then we are ready for the Shabbat, for Shabbos, Yom Shekulo Shabbos, day of the eternal Shabbos. And therefore, even though you can make Shabbos early, that's why Mashiach could come early, you can make Shabbos early, but you can't make Shabbos late, meaning Shabbos cannot come later than the end of 6 days. Ergo, there's a common thought that is often expressed that Mashiach must come no later than the year 6,000. I think I had mentioned Ad Kedei Kach that according to the Torah, the Jewish calendar will expire by the year 6,000, because the Torah says, for sure we won't need the Jewish calendar because we will have a Sanhedrin and we will go back to the sanctification of the new moon based on witnesses. Therefore, there is no need for a calendar, because we will have everything in place that way. Now, this is a very well-known teaching, and it's said all over the place, and yet, conspicuously, it is absolutely absent from the Rambam. Now, I did mention that in a letter, the Rambam gave a remez from his father that prophecy would come back around 1202, etc. But that was a remez, but he did not incorporate that in the Mishneh Torah. And presumably, this is consistent with the Rambam's overall philosophy, which he himself violated in the letter, of not being mechashvei haketz, not getting involved in calculating messianic times. The Rambam just didn't like that whole process, and therefore in the Mishneh Torah, he was not going to indulge in it, even to the extent of giving you a 6,000-year terminus point. Because he says, I'm not going to tell you when, I'm not going to get into when. In fact, his remez from his father is not in the Mishneh Torah, it's only in a private letter. And the Rambam says, Chazal were very, very critical of people that are called mechashvei haketz, people who try to calculate the ketz. But what I want to share with you is a very, very fascinating point, which builds on the 6,000 years, but in a totally, radically different way. Now, I will warn you that this is a Kabbalistic source, and Rav Moshe Meiselman, in a very big book that he wrote on Torah and science, takes great issue with this source, and he considers it to be totally non-authoritative. Again, if you have his book or you look at his book, you'll see that he's very much against this source. On the other hand, the late Rav Aryeh Kaplan, Zichrono Livracha, was very positive about this source, and he used it to explain many things. And let me explain what this source is. The source is from a Kabbalistic work called Sefer HaTemuna. And this is a sefer that is pre-Arizal, so it's even before the Ari. And the Sefer HaTemuna makes the following interesting observation. Just as in the sabbatical cycle of Shemitah, you have 6 years and then a Shemitah year, but that cycle repeats itself 7 times until you have the Yovel, right? Because what happens is, the Yovel, which we don't observe today because you need most of the Jews in Eretz Israel, interestingly enough, there's a fascinating issue, because we're pretty close, actually. We are pretty close to 51%, or 50% plus one. Are we going to have Yovel? That's going to be real, real complicated. You know, remember when some descendants of American Indians wanted to claim Manhattan Island because they claimed that selling the island for $24 of beads was a mekach tot, etc. Well, when Yovel comes, some guy is going to claim the Tel Aviv beach strip, etc. You know, goes back to his grandfather from Shevet Zevulun. Okay, there'll be a lot of questions. In fact, a good parnasa for somebody, if you're thinking about this, a good parnasa when Mashiach comes would actually become a real estate lawyer. Because it'll be based in halacha. Because when Yovel comes, there will be an enormously complicated issue of tracing ownership of land back to the original landholders. That'll be a very, very complicated process when Yovel gets reinstated. But be it as it may, at least when there was Yovel, so what do you have? You have 7 Shemitah cycles culminating in Yovel. So the Sefer HaTemuna says the world will go through 7 cycles of 7,000 years, meaning to say the following. 6,000 years, 1,000 years of Mashiach. Then the world gets recreated at a higher level. 6,000 years, 1,000 years of a higher level of Mashiach. Then 6,000 years, 1,000 years of a higher level of Mashiach, and it gets higher and higher and higher and higher. The Sefer HaTemuna even says that the Torah itself, now this is an amazing, and again, it may be even heretical based on the Rambam, but the Sefer HaTemuna says the Torah itself, the letters of the Torah will never change, but they will be configured into different word patterns reflecting higher and higher spiritual realities. So in one level of the physical world, we talk about meat and milk and chazer and adultery. At a different level, something else will be reflected. The essence of God is in the letters of the Torah. Now, this is a chiddush of the Sefer HaTzimuna that therefore says that the ultimate, ultimate, ultimate redemption will not come after 6,000 years, but will come after 49,000 years, in which you have to have seven Shemitot, and each cycle will have its own type of Mashiach and the like. Now, the question here is this. The question becomes, what cycle are we in? Are we in cycle 1, 2, 3? What cycle are we in? So there are two girsas, there are two nuschaot in the Sefer HaTzimuna. One is we are in the second cycle. So we're not in the first. We are in the second cycle. The other is we are in the sixth cycle. Sixth, number six, meaning there will be one more cycle after us. Now, based on this, the Sefer HaTzimuna says something astounding, which is really peripheral to our discussion, but it's quite, quite amazing. And that is, you know, one of the alleged conflicts between Judaism and science, one of the conflicts, is said to be the age of the earth. We say that the world is only 5,779 years plus 6 days. And 6 days before that. Because Rosh Hashanah, right? 5,779 is the creation of Adam. So it's 5 days. So it's 5,779 plus 5 days. Now the question is, scientists, through carbon dating, through various other ways, they come up with billions of years. How do you reconcile it? Now, again, there's plenty of literature on this. Some say, well, maybe the 6 days of creation were not 24-hour days. Or some say God created the world old. I think that's what Rev Miller says, meaning to say, when Hashem created the world, he created redwood trees. So if you would have been around with Adam HaRishon, and you would have seen a redwood tree, and you would be asked, how old is that tree? And you'd count the rings. You'd say, this tree is 500 years old, even though it was just created. Right? Hashem created things in their full maturity. So Hashem created a world where there's petroleum and where there's coal, even though that comes from the decaying bodies. Right? So that's called the old... It's called the old world theory, meaning Hashem created the world in an old state, right? Different terutzim. But Rav Aryeh Kaplan, again, Zichrono Livracha, uses the Sefer HaTzimuna to make the following argument. Such a fascinating argument. Based, remember, the Sefer HaTzimuna goes back to the 1100s. The 1100s, way before all of these scientific discoveries. That is, there is a chazal that says in the Medrash that Hashem created worlds before this world that he destroyed. But that doesn't have to mean other worlds. That could refer to the cycles in this world that preceded this that were then destroyed by ice ages, by dinosaurs, whatever, by meteors, whatever it would be. So, if we assume we are in the second cycle, there was a cycle of 7,000 years before us. Now, that doesn't add very much, you'll see. Right? So we may have 7,000 years before 5,779. Okay, now, I know, alone that doesn't help you. And if we are in the sixth cycle, there would be 35,000 years. Right? Okay. Now, standing alone, that doesn't really help you very much. So you've added either 7,000 years or 35,000 years. But now, listen to the twist. Listen to this twist. And this is in the Sefer HaTzimuna. In those earlier worlds, there was no Adam. Adam is only in this world. So consequently, the measure of time in the earlier cycles was based on God years rather than man years. What is a God year? We know, God forbid, you know, the Havdil, a dog year, they say 7 years. We go, so... This is the conversion. David HaMelech says, "Ki elef shanim b'yeinecha kayom esmol." 1,000 man years equals a God day. That's the conversion. So, figure this. You have to have a couple little, but you have to keep in, keep the arithmetic. It's not high mathematics, but it's a little. You have to keep the arithmetic in mind. If a day of God equals 1,000 years, then a year of God equals 365,000 years. So as a result, when we say there was a 7,000-year cycle before this creation cycle, that actually meant 365,000 times 7,000, and that will give you a 2,555,000,000. Now, if we are in the sixth cycle, so you have 35,000 years, multiply, I'm not a math genius, I did this beforehand, multiply 365,000 times 35,000, and you are given 12,775,000,000 years. Now, let me point out, what this is doing is, this is not changing the length of the 6 days, meaning to say, once we enter this cycle, the 6 days are 24-hour days, and it's 5,779 years. We're not changing anything about this cycle. A lot of people will say, it's kfira to say that the days of creation are not 24-hour days, because then Shabbos would not be when it is. But you see, the beauty of this pshat is, you're not increasing the zman by redefining the days of creation. You're increasing the zman by looking at the cycles that predated this cycle of creation, based on the Sefer HaTzmunah's interpretation of Bore Olamos U'machriva. So this is quite amazing. This was not an apologetic attempt to reconcile Torah with science, because this was written before science had any. I mean, there was no science. Basically. I mean, there was no science that gave an older age of the earth. And yet, Rav Kaplan discovered this. He discovered this makor from Sefer HaTzmunah. But as I say, Rabbi Meiselman, who writes about Age of the Earth and the like, totally discredits him. He does point out an important thing. It is important that the Arizal rejected this teaching. The Arizal said this teaching was incorrect. So obviously, that's kind of a pretty strong point to make. But Rav Kaplan made another assertion, which is also somewhat controversial, that in matters of hashkafa that do not involve halacha, there is no such thing as a final halachic decision, and therefore, if this helps a person grapple with conflicts, you are permitted to connect yourself to that type of source. Now, that itself is a big machlokas. I don't want to get, maybe that deserves a whole course in and of itself. You may recall, you may have heard of the prominent young rabbi, Rav Natan Slifkin, who really quite a talented person, but he got himself into tremendous hot water a few years ago, from which he has not yet emerged totally, in which he wrote about Judaism and science and how to reconcile Age of the Earth, and he espoused ideas similar to this, and he got in very, very big trouble. So don't quote me on this. I don't want to get into he got into very big trouble. And of course what happened was sometimes the reaction was basically, you know, he reacted in ways that may not have been so respectful, and that made things much worse, etc. But his position was that in hashkafa, in matters that are not nogeil lahalacha, there is no such thing as a psak. A gadol cannot say this idea is no longer acceptable if it has a makor in some earlier sources. But that itself is a machlokas. There's gufa a machlokas. Can there be a psak halacha on non-halachic matters? Right. So that itself is a machlokas. But I can tell you that Arya Kaplan did write explicitly that it was his view that there was no psak halacha on something like Age of the Earth. And I'll tell you another person who one should be aware of, a very, very chush of a person, and you may not never have heard of him. Rav Gedalia Nadal, Zichreino Levracha, was a very unusual person. He was mamish a gadol b'Torah. He was a Talmud of the Chazayin Ish. He was Rav Chaim Kanevsky's chavrusa, and very, very close friend. So he certainly had what you might call the credentials of tremendous chashivas, really a bucky in Shas and Poskim. But he was unconventional. He did not take a position as a Rav or a Rosh Hashiva because he believed in Yafet Talmud Torah and Derech Eretz. So he was a Kablan, he was a farmer, he did all sorts of things. And in fact, when he died, when he was Nifter, and all the Gedolim in B'nai Brak came to his Levaya, they didn't know exactly how to be Masvidim because what he did was not the model that they wanted. So the basic Mahalich was that Rav Gedalia was such a great person that he took a derech that only he could do. Only he could do this. He's chad bedoro, kind of a double. But it's, by the way, it's the same thing the Jewish Observer did with Rav Soloveitchik. They kind of said, his derech, he was so great, only he could do it, nobody else could combine. But Rav Gedalia gave a series of shiurim on creation of the world, Bria Sa'ola. And he said, he talked about the age of the earth, he brought this idea in there. And he also talked about evolution even as a possibility. He said, you know, the ikar that a yid has to believe in is HaKadosh Baruch Hu created everything with a purpose. It didn't just happen by accident. But if he did it this way, that way, this way, that way, he says, it's Yitachin. Hashem may have used many, many processes. He says that is not a question of Ikrei Emunah. Now, Rav Nadal is not Slifkin. I mean, Slifkin could get into big trouble for this. Rav Nadal was mamash a gadol b'Torah, but he didn't publicize this so much. A Talmud took down the notes, so you know you could always say, well, who says the Talmud's notes are accurate? Oh, okay, you know, I don't have any particular proof. But it is important to understand that there are different mahalchim to go into this. But as I say, the beauty of the Sefer HaTemunah is much deeper, I think, because you don't have to get into evolution and you don't have to change anything in Bereishis. Bereishis is mamash exactly the way it's written. And all of this extra years are these cycles that existed before this world was created, and that's Merumas in the Medrash, Borei Olamot U'machriva. Right, so this is much less controversial than bringing in evolution and other things. Let me just end with one final word to get a little bit of a digression, but this idea of Hashem had prior worlds that he destroyed. You know, Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, in the 1960s, there was a year in which he suffered three devastating losses. He lost a brother he was very close to, he lost his mother, and he lost his wife. Mamash, three avelos in 1 year. And in truth, although Baruch Hashem, he was able to teach for more than a decade afterwards, but he never recovered from that. He was a different person, especially with his wife. He was extremely close, and it was very, 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 very difficult. But he said a classic vort. He said, Borei, when he got up from the last Shiva, Borei lama samachrivan, God made many worlds that he destroyed. What was the purpose of Hashem making worlds that he destroyed? Why go through that? Why didn't he just make the one that he wanted? Even that one he destroyed with Noah. And he said, because Hashem is teaching us a lesson. We have to emulate HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He had a world and his world was destroyed, but he went on to rebuild. He didn't stop and give up. So Hashem went through the exercise of creating and then losing to show that even when our world is destroyed, we go on and we recreate. So Hashem did it for us, so we should learn not to succumb, not to give up, to keep on going. This has been the great history of Am Yisrael. This is the upside of Am Kishei Orif. You know, Am Kishei Orif in the Torah is often negative, stiff-necked, stubborn. Yeah, we are stubborn, and that sometimes turns out to be not a good thing. But there's a real positive in that. We don't get crushed. We don't get defeated. There are crusades and pogroms, and there are holocausts and terrorism even today that we face, lo aleinu. But the Yid has emunah in Hashem, and the Yid has emunah that Hashem will give them the resources to achieve the victories that they have to achieve, both in their spiritual lives and in their physical sviva. That, of course, is the story of Purim in and of itself. Not to give up, to turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he will give us a Yeshua, B'Yisora. So I guess I want to wish you all a really, really joyous and wonderful Purim. May Purim be a Zman of Geula and Yeshua for Am Yisrael and for the whole world. Thank you. Yes, I am. Yes, that's exactly right. That was the corrective to that.
Well, no. Yeah, I need to go to the
That's awful.